Welcome to the Competent Pastor Podcast.
A podcast by pastors for pastors that starts with one question.
What is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
We're your hosts. I'm Michael Danner.
And I'm Rachel Ringenberg-Miller.
Today we're thrilled to talk to Bishop Leslie W. Francisco III. The bishop is the oversight pastor of Calvary Community Church, known as C3 Hampton, and the presiding bishop of Calvary Covenant Ministries, Inc., an organization which provides spiritual oversight and counsel, as well as ministerial and administrative support to churches throughout the United States and abroad. On July 1, 1986, Francisco was ordained as pastor of Calvary Mennonite Church in Newport News, Virginia. However, in October of 1990, after much counsel with his spiritual father, Bishop Leslie W. Francisco II, Francisco entered full-time ministry along with his wife, Natalie. Together, they merged the Newport News congregation with Calvary Community Church in Hampton. The ministry grew rapidly under their leadership while establishing several ministries: radio, television, print media, Calvary Christian Academy, and Calvary Bible College. Francisco earned a Bachelor's of Arts in Ministry from International Bible College and Seminary in Independence, Missouri, and a Master of Arts as well as a Doctorate of Ministry from Carolina University of Theology. In addition to being a prolific preacher and teacher, he is also an FAA-certified private pilot and an author of several books, including his latest titles, The 21st Century Man, How to Succeed in Changing Times, and Dating and Relating, Friends with Benefits, both by St. Paul Press. Bishop Leslie and Dr. Natalie are the parents of three beautiful daughters, Nicole, Leslie, and Lauren, two sons-in-law, Phil and Caleb, and the grandparents of three grandsons and one granddaughter, Phil, Jackson, Nico, and Skylar. So we're thrilled to be here with Bishop Leslie Francisco III. Bishop, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for taking the time to talk about what it means to be a pastor. Can you begin by just letting us know, like, what is your journey, or how did you become a pastor, and what's your experience been?
Okay. Well, first, let me say thank you for the opportunity to share, and I appreciate the time that we'll spend together today. My journey as a pastor was an interesting one. I grew up as a PK, so my father was actually what I would say a third generation Anabaptist. So I'm fourth, and my children are fifth, and my grandchildren will be sixth. So we've got a long tenure in church world and Anabaptism. But as I think about it, growing up being a pastor's child, it was high on my agenda that I never wanted to be involved in church work. That was my number one goal, was not to be a part of the church in terms of any leadership positions, because I kind of saw how my father was treated, and I didn't have a lot of appreciation for that. But as it turned out, God changed my heart. I was actually in the construction business for about 10 years, and I was building new homes on the peninsula where we live in Virginia. And I started helping my father in leadership, and started off by just doing Sunday school, and then started doing children's ministry, and eventually just doing other types of support things in the background. And he decided that he wanted to start another church, build another building, and create a church there. And so he had a pastor that was going to continue in the ministry where we were located. And 2 weeks before the whole transition took place, the guy backed out. And so I asked my wife, I said, I wonder what my father's going to do now. And he called me and said, hey, I need you to help me for a little bit. I just need you to fill in until I got, he said, I have somebody coming, and it's going to be a couple months before they get here. And if you could just fill in, that would be helpful. And I was like, I'm really not a pastor. You know, I don't know much about this pastoring thing, but I've been around church all my life. Long story short, 40 years later, the replacement ended up being my daughter, who just took over 4 years ago. So that's kind of the cliff notes on how I got into pastoral ministry.
So that replacement never came. You meant
two. It never came. Yeah. And by that time, I had felt the sense of, you know, maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. And the reality of that, if I can elaborate just a little more, was, it was a challenging time because, as you know, church life, financially, it just didn't provide what you needed. And, I'm going to put my wife on the spot for a moment. When he asked me to do that, after about 2 years of doing it, I went to my wife and I said, you know, I believe God's calling me to go full-time in ministry. And I said, but, you know, our lifestyle is going to change because the finances are not going to be the same. So it's going to be a total shift. And so if you don't want me to do it, you know, I have no problems. I can continue doing what I'm doing. And she looked at me and she said, if God told you to do it, you need to do it. That's not the answer. I really wanted her to be my out for not.
Yeah.
But here we are. It was definitely God's plan for me to go in this direction and through many journeys. And I'll share some of that later on, how all of this unfolded and moved into where we are now. But yeah, that was kind of an entree into my church experience.
So question for you, what point did you realize, wait a minute, I think this is going to be a permanent thing? Like, did you and your dad have a conversation, or was it something that just kind of just happened, you know, over time, that you were going to be the person in this position?
Well, that first year, especially the first 6 months, I kept asking, when is the person coming? You know, when is it coming? He said, well, they had a little delay. I don't know if he was stretching the truth or if he was just.
Yeah, my question is, was there an actual person or did he just say this to get you in the position?
I think he knew. I really think he knew that I was supposed to be the person in the position. And I think that he was giving me an opportunity to feel that sense of call. And after a year, I kind of developed a sense that, you know, maybe this is where I'm supposed to be, and making a difference in people's lives in a way that's not just, and I'll put it this way, this is how it came to me. You can build homes or you can build lives. And in the process of building lives, you can build homes. And so it was moving from a physical building to a spiritual building and helping to support families. So our ministry actually morphed into a family-oriented ministry where we were actually targeting families and building stronger communities through family.
That's cool. Well, maybe we'll transition to the question of the day, the question of the Competent Pastor podcast.
Yes. So the question is, what is the most important skill of a competent pastor, in your opinion?
Okay. Well, you're asking a preacher to basically give you a mini sermonette.
Go for it.
This is really what caused me to have a sense of call to ministry. And I identify these skills because going into ministry, even though I had been around church world, church life all my life, I really didn't understand the ins and outs and the mechanics of how it really worked. And so I learned a lot from people who were successful as well as from people who were unsuccessful in ministry, to try and, you know, observe and look at their lives and their ministries and, what worked, what didn't work. One of the things that really moved me, was the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah literally became my, mentor in church world, church life. We were in a community that was underserved, and it was a challenging time because most of the people there were on public assistance, needed help, and I saw what I considered the desperation in the community, and I was at saying, God, you know, I want to make a difference. I'm not just I just don't want to get up and preach on Sundays, go home, and that's it. And then we come back the next Sunday and we just go through this, rote activity every week. And so, my wife and I really wanted to make an impact, and Nehemiah, like I said, became really the catalyst for, I began to study his life And what really captivated me was when I began to understand what Nehemiah did, someone came to him with a complaint or sharing. Well, he asked, how is Jerusalem doing? And they told him, the walls are burned down, the gates are burned down, people are in disarray. And as I did research on that, that had been going on for 140 years, those walls were torn down, the gates were burned down, and people were just kind of into business as usual. I kind of looked at that and said, hey, that's kind of where I am. People have kind of gotten used to this lifestyle, and it's just the way it is. And so studying Nehemiah's life, I found out that after 140 years of dormancy, he was able to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem in 52 days. I was blown away. Like, man, you mean to tell me these people stayed in this position for 140 years and this one guy comes in 52 days and changes it? So looking at his life, there were seven characteristic traits that I picked up from Nehemiah. Number one was visionary. And I think that's extremely important for any pastor, any competent pastor, I should say, is that they are a visionary that's grounded really in faith and strong faith, enabling them to see possibilities that others overlook or even dismiss. And so the visionary, as I developed into my life, I asked myself this question: are you called to maintain status quo or to motivate and inspire others to grow and change? And that's what I saw in the life of Nehemiah. So without a vision, you know the scripture, the people perish. And so pastors, I think, must have a vision and strong faith. We didn't have the resources to do the things that I envisioned, but I had the faith. And that was one gift that my father gave me was faith. I've seen my father do some things, and I'm like, that's not going to work. but he had strong faith. He was just that kind of person. And it really bolstered my faith. Quick story. He used to do street evangelism. Now, I really think my father was an evangelist. That was his real gift, his real call. And he would have us, his sons, it was three of us. He would have us, we're going to go out. And he would go out in the middle of the street, block the street off. I'm like, Daddy, you can't do that. God said do it. I'm like, but you just can't block off a street and just think you can have church in the middle. He would do it. So I'm like, okay, we're going to jail today, but okay, that's,
yeah,
you know, nothing. Police would come out and support him. You know, they'd block him. I'm like, okay, how did this happen? It would be, the clouds would be so heavy, looking like it's getting ready to pour down rain. And I'm just like, thank you. We don't have to do it today. Load up the truck. We had this big piano, like in the cowboy movies, the big bar piano. We'd load that thing up, and a little platform stage we'd built, and he'd put all that stuff up. I said, but it's going to rain. He said, we're going. We'd go out, set everything up. He'd do the service. We'd get the last chair back in the church. Boom, here comes the rain. So he taught me faith. He taught me how to deal with impossible situations. But again, number one, I think, is they have to be a visionary, really grounded, strong in faith. Shall I continue or do you want me to?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay. The second thing that I extrapolated from Nehemiah was organizational skills. And effective pastors have to have this. I used to preach a sermon entitled, "If You Want to See a Miracle, Get Organized." And I've taught that to our church. But I think effective pastors have to develop and implement strategic plans that other people can envision and support. It was Nehemiah who organized the people to get the walls rebuilt. And he was able to find out all of the different skill sets and put them in the right place in the right position. And for me, I think that that was a really big part of what I did in ministry. Some of my business acumen from running a business, I was able to bring over into the church world and to begin to say, we have to have a strategic plan on how we're going to do what we're set out to do, what we're called to do. And so we embraced Nehemiah, and I began to teach him a lesson on his theme, where the people have a mind to work. That was one of Nehemiah in the scripture there. And so I set that up as that was part of who we were. We are Calvary Community Church at that time. We were building community, we're restoring hope, and we're transforming lives. That's what we do. And I preached that a thousand times. We're building community. So people say, well, we need to have prayer meetings. We need to do that. We're building community. We're restoring hope. We're transforming lives. We need to feed the hungry, and we're building community. We're restoring hope. We don't do everything, but what we do do is we build community, we restore hope, and we transform lives. So organizing that and putting it in a platform where people could plug in. And so you take and you plug people where they fit in. Sometimes you try to put a square peg in a round hole. It doesn't work just because a person has a degree or because a person has a particular skill. It may not fit in that particular arena. So organizing and creating where people can plug in and do what they're called to do is monumental. So I think that was my second point. I have five more. So I got seven, but
well, it's a perfect number.
Okay. Yeah. I'm curious about how one and two go together, that idea of you having a vision, but then actually the organizational skills that you had from, if I understand you right, from business, from that kind of being able to take a house from an empty lot to a building there, that helped you make the vision reality? Is that?
That's the whole point. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I even learned that in business, because the first few years I knew building from A to Z. And, I remember one day I was working, we were working on a home, and I was up on a ladder, and the thought entered my mind, okay, what are you going to do when you finish here? And I was like, so I got a crew working for me. I'm like, okay, I don't know. I think something will come up. And that's when I realized that knowing how to build and knowing when and where to build are two different things. Mm-hmm. And so I put my tool belt down and went to organizing and administration. And so instead of building two houses a year, we started building 10, because mm-hmm. I was able to, you know, organize and put things in motion and say, well, my job is to acquisition of land and deal with bankers and real estate people, whatever, you know, the case may be. So yeah, that became monumental in my church work, was to bring those skills into the church world.
Could you say what skills you brought over from your business life? Because what I find with newer pastors or pastors who are in their first position is this piece, the organizational piece, is like the piece that they are, they have the least education around or least experience with. And they thought they were just going to go in and preach some sermons and do some pastoral care. But oh no, they have to prepare for the board meeting, or they have to, you know, figure out what the sermon series is going to be and then contact people, right? So like kind of skills did you bring?
Well, I think, and I'll answer that twofold. The first thing is going back to point number one was understanding what your function is. Are you there as a pastor to maintain or be in a maintenance mode, or do you really have a call to create growth and change the lives of people? There's two different things. If I'm just being called to come and preach, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to follow standard protocol. I'm just going to go with the flow. I'm not going to try to make any changes, because I know what you want me to do. I'm going to go to the board meetings. I'm going to prepare a sermon series. I'm going to preach. But that's not what I'm called to do as a pastor. As a pastor, I'm called, and here's my other little buzzword, I'm a legacy maker and a curse breaker. That's what I do. I create legacy. So my whole passion and drive in life was to make a difference, to see people's lives change from, okay, what brought you to this point in life, to say, okay, we're going to make a shift now. And you are the catalyst for that shift. God brought you on this earth because all of the things that have come to you and up to this point, you are that person that God has assigned to be different and to take the next generation into a different trajectory. So if a pastor does it, and you can't put that in a person, but if they don't have that, at least that kind of training, maybe I ought to go to a seminary and say, hey, I'll teach a course on that. But I think they need that understanding that you are there not just for maintenance. You're there to create momentum. And so what skills did I bring? Again, I bought the administrative skills. I bought the vision because most churches are stuck in status quo. We do what we do because we've always done it that way. That's how we've always done it. We've sung these songs. Every fourth Sunday we have potluck. You know, we have vacation Bible school. We do this, you know, and that's just what we do. And it's already preset. Mm-hmm. So I think I bought the dynamic of change, and that change was, it really pushed our leadership because, and I'll talk about leadership too, but as a pastor, I didn't feel that I was the leader. I felt I was the person that was just doing the bidding of the board. And these people had jobs. They weren't in church every day, but they were the ones that were supposedly creating the vision for the church. And I'm sitting there scratching my head. You're working 40, 50 hours a week. You come here to meet me on Tuesday night to tell me how to do my job, but you have no clue as to what my call is on my life. And so how does a group of people who don't live in the church world, who don't understand the dynamic of outreach and building other individuals' lives and community, how do you lead a pastor to lead? So that was a dynamic that I bought into, the element that my leaders didn't appreciate when I first came on board.
Well, I would love to hear more about that, right? I mean, that is the crux, or that is the issue a lot of pastors have, is working with their leadership board. And you talked about knowing your function, and you were coming and bringing the change. So how did maybe this is jumping ahead in your points, but just wondering about that leadership component. How did you work at that?
I can just say, I just heard like a bunch of future pastors listening to this podcast say amen when you finish that description. Because exactly. It is one of the most significant frustrations of every pastor and even leader. I've worked in conference level, denominational level. It's the frustration of everyone that's day to day invested in doing this work. And then you're accountable to a board that's doing this part time, sometimes haven't even read the board minutes when they come into the room, don't understand the issues. And it's really, really hard. Yeah. So, yeah, answer Rachel's question now.
Well, the how is, I don't think the how is a cookie cutter, so I don't think it works for every scenario. I think you have to have a sense of discernment as a pastor and understand who you are working with, and then basically ask them the questions. What is your vision for our community? What is your vision for our church? What is it? Where do you see us 5 years from now? Where do you see us 10 years from now? So you challenge the edges of the envelope by asking them the questions that God's already placed in your heart, and you put the shoe on the other foot. And then when they start stuttering and can't really give you concrete answers, and they want to create committees to study it and say, okay, well, who are those persons? What qualifies them to do that kind of study? What have they been in the community? What is their level of involvement in going out to the community and reaching people? How are they impacting their world? So I started asking the tough questions to the leadership team. And as you begin to ask those questions, it challenges them. And then you say, well, may I suggest that we possibly entertain this concept or this idea? And it's a slow building process. And the other thing, Rachel, that I did, which probably shook us to the core, I took and did a 6-month series on the roles of every leadership position in the church. And I preached it from the pulpit. And so I preached about the role of the usher, the role of the deacon, the role of the elder, the role of the board, the role of the pastor. I said, when I preached about the role of the pastor, I said, you know, I've discovered that when people go into leadership, I've heard people say, I would rather be a deacon or an assistant pastor or a superintendent, a Sunday school superintendent or a Sunday school teacher, because when you become a pastor, everybody knows what the pastor should do, but nobody knows what the deacon does. Nobody knows what the Sunday school superintendent does. And nobody, they don't. But ask any person on the street, what is a pastor's job? And you'll get a whole litany of things, because they just already know this is what you're supposed to do. So I reversed it, and I just started preaching. What is the role of a Sunday school teacher? What is the role of the usher? What is the role of the greeters? What is the role of the board members? I even remember preaching saying, when you read the scripture, it says when they appointed deacons in the church grew. Mm. I said, so if the church is not growing, don't look at me. Go talk to the deacons. It's their fault. So, I mean, it's those type of things that I think you're causing me to reflect now, but it's those kind of things that I begin to share. Yeah.
How were those sermons received?
In the beginning, they were a little challenging. We were only about 40 members.
Okay.
And when I started, so it was really harder, and you might want to keep this, you can cut it. It was harder for me to pastor 40 people than it was 1,200.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that? I have some ideas why that might be, but can you say more?
The smaller the church, the more people are involved.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks it's their church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are the ones that make the decisions, mm-hmm. and they're used to that. And they don't really, most of the time when you find churches comfortable in that zone, they really don't want growth. Mm-hmm. They really don't want anybody to upset the apple cart. They don't want anybody to come in and change. It's comfortable for them. Everybody knows everyone. And when a new person comes in, people turn around looking at them. And they get these stares, and I had to teach our congregation, don't do that. I had to teach them about, so you get all my old sermons, get ready for new people. Yeah. I preach a sermon on get ready for new people. And I said, they're not going to look like us. They're not going to act like us. They're not going to talk like us, think like us, or even smell like us. I said, they're new people. So get ready. And that's what we're here for, to make an impact. But again, when I go back, I was going to say, yeah, that shifted because we probably, when I started doing this, lost maybe half of our congregation.
Wow.
But in hindsight, that was probably the best thing that could ever happen to the church.
Mm-hmm. Did they leave because they didn't? Yeah.
They were used to, they had the final say. And mm-hmm. when they said it, it happened, and mm-hmm. that was the way it was going to be. And now you got this new kid in town who's challenging the edges, and I don't think they. And I must say, it wasn't from a dictatorial perspective. It was in love, and it was. I mean, I have passionate call to do that. So, it didn't come across as abusive, and you got to do it this way. Yeah, no. It's us. We're in this together. So. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll get on a little rabbit trail, and
we find the rabbit trails are the most interesting.
Okay.
I mean, essentially, what I hear you describing is you basically said to the church. Like we're a community where everybody's responsible for the thriving of the whole. And this is your role. This is your role. These are the various things, but you're expected to use your gifts in ministry in this community and to reflect Jesus to people when they come. Like you're helping them be responsible and naming that, right? And some people aren't comfortable with that. Like they want to come in, they want to sit down, you want to hear a sermon, you want to be inspired, you want to sing some songs, you want to go home. And then let the pastor do all the work, right? So in a real sense, you're describing what we euphemistically call it, like the priesthood of all believers is the tagline. But it's this idea that we're a body.
We're all doing it together.
I could get where that could be uncomfortable for some folks.
But that is the life of the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, the church that we are called to be salt and light. That's the life of the church. And I think too many churches get caught in, we're stuck in our comfort zones, and we don't want anybody to upset that. And so, you know, when I studied the life of Nehemiah, that's exactly what he did. He knew who were the masons. He knew who were the carpenters. He knew he had the cooks cooking. So he put everybody where they fit. And the community is something amazing that the community start working together. And when the community start working together, one morning they woke up and 140 years we've been sitting in this squalor and now it's done in 52 days. Because he brought people together to actually be in community. So
I'm interested in that image. When you think about like the church today in America, it can be the Anabaptist Church, Mennonite Church USA or whatever. Are there ways in which you can see that we as a community have become comfortable in being in disarray?
Oh, most definitely. I think, again, people get enveloped into their bastion and their way of doing things, and they're comfortable with that. When you literally start becoming a church, not only to the people in the pews, but to the community, it changes the whole dynamic. One of my sermons, I got up on Sunday morning and I told the congregation, I said, this is my last Sunday being the pastor of this church. There's a holy hush fell over the congregation. I said, from this day forward, God called me to pastor the community. And so I'm pastoring the community. Not just the people in the four walls of this building. It revolutionizes the mentality of the church, because now you are opening your doors to people who think differently. And again, I had to teach on that, because when we started reaching out, we had people coming in that. I mean, our ushers at the door were so entrenched in tradition that when ladies would come in the church who weren't familiar with our style, they would stand at the door with these little dollies and pin them on the ladies' heads and say, you got to cover your head. You can't come in. You remember when they used to wear the little white caps?
I don't, but I heard it happened.
Yeah. Oh, but then they evolved to just little dollies and not the white caps, but you had to put something on your head. I remember that vividly. I'm like, we're not doing that anymore. Oh God, that's blasphemy. but we're reaching people that don't, why do you do it? And I used to ask those questions. Why do you do that? Well, that's what you're supposed to do. And that was the answer I'd get most of the time. Whenever I try to do something, it would change the things. It just, that's what we've always done. And, but we started seeing people come in. I mean, they weren't dressing the way we were dressing. They weren't talking like we were talking. And I had to encourage the kind of, leave these people alone. And when they come in, don't turn around looking at them, giving them strange stares. We got to embrace them, love them. And one of the things that Calvary is known for now is a church of love. When you walk in the door, we've taught our greeters and our ushers to be loving and kind. Welcome everybody. I don't care who you are. You're welcome. And if you welcome them, from the time you come into the parking lot to the time you come through those front doors to the time you come into the sanctuary, you've had three contact points of welcome. Now, it's easier for me to preach to you, but if that parking lot attendant or that greeter at the door gave you a sour look, I'm already done. My sermon is void. There's nothing I can say because you already developed a mindset that these people are not real. Mm-hmm. And so it's training the entire church to be, as you said, Michael, the community of believers that's working in harmony, and it creates a flow, a rhythm of this is who we are. This is what we do.
The question I have for you within that story, so what was your experience then when someone would say, well, this is what we always do, when you asked a question, what was your follow-up, or how did you kind of move through that kind of that block or that hand up?
There's another story, another sermon, where I taught about the wife who was cooking a ham. Mm. And she cut it in half and put it in two pots. You remember? And she cut the ham in half. And so he asked her, why do you do that? And she said, my mother did it. So he went to her mother and he asked her, why do you cut the ham and put it in two pots? And she said, well, my mother did it. So he went to the grandmother and asked, why do you cut the ham and put it in two pots? Because your daughter does it. My wife does it. And they said they do it because you did it. And she said, I don't know why they're doing it, but I didn't have a pot big enough to put the ham in.
Yes.
She said, so I had to cut it in half, put it in two pots. So here they are, right, two generations later, cutting the ham, cooking it in two pots because it was done that way back then. But when you start going back, asking the question, why do we do what we do? And you have to let them answer that question, not you. Not you come up with the answer, the pastor, and say, why? Why do we wear the doilies on the head? Or why do we have to have a feet washing on this particular Sunday? Or why do we have fellowship lunches every fourth Sunday? Or why? And when you do the history and you start going back researching, you find out there was a valid reason for it then that may not be apropos today. So, that's how I dealt with it, at least. Yeah, mm-hmm. I would ask the why question.
Mm-hmm. I just love that you refer to those as doilies.
Do they have a different name? I don't know.
I thought doilies were like the little pattern. Well, I don't, they look like
they
it.
They looked like doilies.
And that's what they were. That's what they were putting on people's heads. The doily. Yeah, it was like a little lace pattern.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
I don't know.
It was something that was inherited.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it didn't change the. And my point would always be, it's not changing the life or the lifestyle of a person.
Yeah.
You're trying to fit them into a box that was created for you, mm-hmm. But it's not creating a change in their lives. So how do we create a change in generational destiny? Mm-hmm. That's my thing. You know, I'm always just like, what are we doing to create change generationally? How are we equipping the next generation to take this to another level? And, yeah.
So I noticed, yeah, the three things you talked about, building community. I can't remember the second one, something to do with hope.
Restoring hope.
Restoring hope, and then changing lives.
Transforming lives.
Transforming lives. Okay. So as you think about like transforming lives, that had to have some, you had to have kind of a vision for what that meant or some understanding of what that meant in order to.
Or look like in your context.
Yeah. So what, how did you define that? What does a transformed life look like? And then how did you create a context or an environment in your church whereby people could actually experience that transformation? What?
One of the things that really pushed that edge of the envelope was I was pastoring a church and we had one college graduate in our church and zero youth that were going to college after graduation from high school. My mother-in-law was a school teacher, so she was the only person in our congregation that was a college graduate at that time. and education was high for my wife and I, as we understood that that was a gateway to, you know, escape of having a better life. And so we started teaching that. My wife developed some Sunday school programs and curriculums that could meet our youth where they were. And we started a trajectory of just scaling that. And so we went from high school graduates going to college to probably about 95% of our youth going to college. And so that's one way of transforming lives. The second way was we did a lot of teaching on financial literacy, helping our congregation and members understand it's not how much you make, it's what you do with what you make, and helping them to be empowered in that particular scenario. We did a lot of teaching on family, and we modeled that as a family as well. I had three daughters, and my wife and I, we tried to model what family would look like for our congregation. So our children were involved in church life, and and I mean, when I say involved, we were all involved. I mean, I was the pitcher on the baseball team, you know, on softball team. When we had projects and things, we were in the mix. We didn't kind of stand out here and say, hey, y'all do this, y'all do that. When we had community events, we were there. So it's that whole process of modeling. And I think Nehemiah taught me that as well. You've got to model what you expect to get out of it. So transformation came through replication and just being visual and letting people see that you can change your life. You can excel. You can break out of that mold. And not 100% success rate, but we've had some good success in that area. So, yeah.
Thanks.
So where are we on the Nehemiah list here? We've got...
Well, we've kind of jumped all over it, but I think we're going down to number three, communication. Just a pastor has to be able to have good communication skills. And a part of that is moving beyond the fear of overstepping boundaries. I think young pastors especially are fearful when they go into a setting, what can I say or what can I not say? But again, if they go in with the perspective of uplifting, of creating change and encouraging, I think you can say just about anything you want to say. But letting people, and I'll say this, letting people see your heart. Words are one thing, but is it here? I mean, are you communicating that? Do they feel you? They feel you're genuine. Are you here really? Is it a job, or do you really, really care about us in the community? And so when people see your heart, they and you communicate that, not only verbally, but when you communicate that with your being, it makes a difference. The fourth thing was leadership. Again, I think we talk about leadership a lot in Mennonite Church. We train pastors, we send them to school, we educate them, and we call them leaders, and then we send them into a congregation and tell them, don't lead. You're a pastor, but don't lead.
Say more. Keep going.
Yeah. So, no, I think pastors are called to lead, and I say that unapologetically.
Yes.
They're congregations, but they have to do it with strength. They have to do it with empathy, and they have to do it with integrity. It's not a cookie cutter role where you just come in and feel the position. But I think strong leadership, it motivates, it inspires, it provides direction, and a true leader understands that. And I think the church has to step up to the plate and trust. Do you trust your pastor to lead? Not to just follow. Again, I go back to that. I can't follow the directives of people who are working 40, 50 hours a week. and you're still dealing with your family issues, you're still dealing with, and then you're going to come here for 2 hours on Tuesday night and tell me how to do my job. I'm here 24/7 involved in the community. I'm praying. I'm seeking God. I'm looking for vision and direction. You're trying to figure out how to do what you do. And that's fine. I applaud that. Do what you do, but let me do what I do. And you call me to this position. You appointed me to this role. Now let me lead. And that's and I don't know how to communicate that, to congregations, because again, tradition has, and fear of leadership in Mennonite church has just run rampant, that people are fearful of leadership. That, and I'm asking the question, what are they going to do? I mean, what are you fearful of? Are they going to take the church? I mean, what do you think? You're going to wake up one morning and they'd have packed the church up on a U-Haul and taking it down, you know, to another community or something? What are you fearful of as a congregation? Are you fearful of change? Are you fearful of new ideas? Are you fearful of maybe someone has a level of competency that you don't have, or insight that you don't have? What are you afraid of? And maybe if I can get on the evangelistic trail, I can go around and preach those messages in some churches. What are you guys afraid of? Let your pastor lead.
I mean, I think maybe you do need to start a series of that and go around to churches, because I do think that is an issue, or something that pastors run into, especially in their new positions. Like, I've heard from multiple new pastors where the church hires them and like, oh, we're so excited to have you. We're so excited for like new, fresh ideas. Usually these pastors are young and the pastor's super excited and they go into like maybe their first board meeting, like, hey, this is what I'm thinking. And the board's like, no. And then sometimes they're able to move through, but other times the pastor just gets fed up. And then they leave the church and potentially leave ministry completely. So what is your, knowing that not every situation, you can't just plug in right advice, but like, what has been your experience of that? Or what have you done when you've experienced pushback, but as the leader, as the visionary leader, change maker, like how do you work with that?
I think that's point number five.
All right. We'll get to point number five.
This is point number five. You, as a leader, you can't be easily distracted or discouraged. A competent pastor has to understand you are always going to have naysayers and challenges. You're going to always have that Sanballat and that Tobiah that's trying to get you to come down off the wall, trying to distract you, trying to keep you. And that was Nehemiah. See, I learned all these lessons from Nehemiah. You got that group of people that's just what their assignment is, to make your life a hell. Oh, I'm not going to say hell, but to make your life miserable. Yeah. That's, and they feel good. I mean, I'm in the people business. I know people. And that some people really, that's their thing. I'm going to make the pastor's life as miserable. They won't say it, but inside, it's not, I'm just going to keep them in turmoil. And a pastor, I say this to young people, you got to have tough skin. You can't go into this with tissue paper feelings. You can't go into this easily hurt, easily discouraged or distracted. You got to understand your assignment. And here's your assignment. You are called to shepherd the flock of God. What does a shepherd do? A shepherd leads the green pastures and still waters. You ought to take the people to where they can be refreshed and where they can produce much, so that when it's time to shear the sheep, they're healthy. because you've taken them to the place where there's green pastures and still waters. And so as a pastor, you have to have resilience and determination, that understanding that's the key to effective ministry. So, I mean, this is not a position or a job for the faint of heart. You just can't function in this role. If you're super sensitive, or they said something about me, I could tell the way they were looking at me, and oh, they, you probably need to change your profession. I'll just give you that piece of, don't waste the next few years trying to figure out, because if you're super sensitive, this is not for you. You will have blows, attacks coming your way, and they may seem cloaked in niceness, but it comes with the territory.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Ooh, not for the faint of heart.
Am I getting too transparent here?
It's up to you. I think this is great.
Yeah, it's better than, I mean, every pastor I know experiences exactly what you're talking about. It's just the first time it hurts. But if no one's told you to look out for it,
right,
it can be pretty unsettling for folks. But yeah, you do have to have thick skin. And
because challenge, they're always there. I mean, mm-hmm. somebody's not going to like what you preached, and somebody's going to slip a little note. I've had my feelings challenged so many times. I just, okay, it comes with the terror. Mm-hmm. That's what I signed up for. And
now they put her on Instagram and social media in full blast, right?
right. And
get their friends involved.
it creates more havoc. Always remember what's your job. You're there to shepherd. You're there to take people to a place of restoring hope and transforming lives and building community. You're there to make an impact. And I think it's important to understand that it's a part of what your assignment is. So.
Right. And to remember that, you know, there's always going to be, as you were saying, 2, 3, 4, I don't know, people who don't like what you're doing. And so you have to decide, or maybe be intentional on, when do you listen to voices? Because sometimes those are good critiques. And when to say, you know what? No, I'm doing the thing that God's called me to do.
Exactly.
And I have the support of everyone else in the congregation. So here I go, you know, head up.
And I think too, as I will say this, pastoring is probably one of the loneliest positions that you could ever have. It is not, you're not there to be liked by people. You're not there to create friendships. I mean, even though you have friends, but there's an invisible wall that you cannot cross that line, because you are not the flock. You're not one of the sheep. You are the shepherd. And that's not a heady thing. That's not lifting you up. It's an understanding that you have to have. When I look at the life of Jesus, Jesus led the multitude. He had the 5,000, the 70 that he sent out 2 by 2. He had the 12 disciples. When he really, really, really got into the thick of it, he said, Peter, James, and John, you come with me. And on the cross, guess how many people he had? John. It was only one disciple.
Some women.
Yeah, and the women. Exactly. So, but, I mean, that was it. And so, you got to understand, are you better than Jesus? I mean, you know, so don't get discouraged when things don't go the way you think they should go. I've had people come and go. And I've learned how to bless that. I've learned how to say, I appreciate your time here. And if you feel it's time that you move on, no explanations needed. Thank you. We really appreciate you. And I pray to God bless you in your future endeavors. Sometimes we get caught up in the minutia because we want to dig into the details when it's unnecessary. I've learned that when people decide they want to go a different course, they've already made a decision. It's okay. It's okay. I bless you, and I trust you can bless me, and we can go and continue the journey. So,
you probably don't even remember telling me this once, but a number of years ago, we were talking about a similar topic. It's kind of related. Is that really the importance of having, like, so there's a lot of noise in terms of feedback and negative stuff that people bring, but there's also, like, you need to have trusted advisors or friends or people around you that you trust, that are able to give you good feedback, and that you have to listen to, because that'll help you grow. And if you don't, yeah. So just it's not just everybody that, like, there's some people you really need to listen to, and have those folks in your life.
And I would say, and a lot of that many times are not people in your congregation.
Yeah.
Yeah. They would be outside trusted.
Yeah.
Confidants that you can share your heart with, people that you can, again, respond to and mm-hmm. take their counsel. Cause it's very difficult to establish that kind of relationship in the congregation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, for a bishop, for oversight leaders or whatever people names they give them, to have those kind of persons in place that, you know, it's a safe place. And here's what I'm going through. What counsel do you have for me? Mm-hmm. Or can you pray for me? Most of the time when I talk to pastors, I mean, I just listen. they pretty much, they already know what they need to do. Mm-hmm. But they just need somebody to listen to them and say, it's okay. I'll pray with you. And, I know you've already heard from God on this area. So it's not like I'm telling you what to do or how to do it, mm-hmm. but I'm listening. So.
Was there ever a time in the 40 years you were at C3 Calvary as the acting pastor that you thought, this is it, I'm done, I'm not going to be able to keep going as pastor or leader of this community? Anything like that? And if, you know, if that's too personal of a question, that's fine. But
we'll edit that out.
Yes is the answer.
Yeah.
Yes, there was times. Yeah. I vividly remember one Sunday morning, I got my family together. We went to church and, Sunday school was going on, and I went into my office and trying to think of a kind way to say this. I was in my office and it was a tough time. It was things mm-hmm. going on and just feeling the strain. And, I sat in my office and I said, you know what? I don't need this. At skills. I'm here.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, these people don't like me. And right now I don't like them.
Yeah.
I'm quitting. Mm-hmm. And you know what I did? I got in my car. I left on Sunday morning. I got in my car and I took off and I left my family.
That's my question. Was your family still in church?
In church. And nobody knew where I was. And I said, I'm done. I said, I'm just done. I'm tired of them. And I know they're tired of me trying to get them to go somewhere that they don't want to go. And so my father was, he was ailing at that time, but, I said, well, he's the one that called me to this. I said, so I at least owe it to him to go and tell him. I'm quitting. I went and went to his house and I went in and talked to him and told him, you know, I can't do this. And he just asked me a question. He said, are you doing this for you or are you doing it for God? And that's why when I said you need somebody in your life that you can confide in. He didn't have a whole lot of words to say, but he made me think. And I tucked my tail between my legs, ate some humble pie, and went back. And I loved on the people, in spite of. So, yes, Michael, there were occasions that I did not feel the Spirit of God and the anointing and the zeal to go on. And but there was always that check there somewhere along the line that someone would speak a word or I would have a trusted somebody in my life that would remind me of why you are doing this. This is not about you. It's bigger than you. And so, I never forgot that yeah. it's bigger than me. Everything I do is bigger than me. I'm just a tool.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that story because I think sometimes we see people who've had long tenures like yourself and think, oh man, I'm sure they never, you know, had this moment where like they were, said, I'm out. And you literally left, which is amazing. Because I've had that thought too, but I've never left.
But I told my wife after it happened, she said, "You left us." And I was like, I was just up to here. I couldn't take anymore. But, and I've had a couple of those moments along the way. Mm-hmm. But again, the reminder that this is not about you.
Yeah.
It's about the call on your life. So, hey, well, I think that's about, we've kind of covered, I had two other points, but we've kind of mixed them in. I was talking about pastoral care was number six, and okay. then empowering and motivating others. So that's kind of where I would wrap up. So, yeah. My sixth point, just so you want to jot it down, was pastoral care. Pastors should really actively engage in pastoral care to just foster strong connections with the church and the community. Mm-hmm. To just join those two together, it's real important that the church doesn't see itself, doesn't see itself as separate or just an elitist group of people. We got God and you don't. We're working in concert together. And then the seventh point was empowering and motivating others. Nehemiah, you know, he kept encouraging the people and he empowered them to believe in their purpose and to press on. So, yeah.
I'm glad you went to all seven because we'd have had some people going, "Hey, wait a minute.
He said there were seven.
And we only got through five. That's a big failure on our part as host." Okay. I'm curious, like, you know, this idea of building community. Like, I was listening to a podcast pastoring about a week ago, and they were talking about how, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, pastors were considered leaders in the community. It was kind of a default position. If you pastored a local church, you're expected to lead in the community. And now we're definitely in a season where pastors are not necessarily welcomed as public leaders in that space. And so, but you're very much focused on being a pastor of a community and having a community-wide vision. What were some of the practical ways that you actually got outside of the church and started to lead in the community? How did you do that? What were some avenues? What were some pushback? And how did you persist in that?
One of the key things that we did was we created a biannual event twice a year that we call Community Unity Day. And we would actually go into the community and we would do it away from the church, go down into an area of the community, whether it was a park or a community center, and we'd get a big trailer with a stage. And then we would have different vendors, different people to come out, and we would just showcase the love of God, whether we'd have singing, no preaching, just singing, people giving out free food, hot dogs and popcorn, and kind of like just a celebratory atmosphere to just say, "Hey, we're here. We're right down the street. This is what we do. You're part of us. We're part of you." And we would have our whole church involved in that. So some people would be doing the popcorn booth. Some people would be doing the hot dogs. Some people would be setting up. That's a part. I mean, that's a part of community. They would be setting up the stage and hooking up the mics and carrying the equipment, bringing the chairs out. Have play bounce those bounce things where kids can go and play. And so just creating a whole event that didn't cost anybody anything. But that was the church coming out of the building, going into the community, saying, "Here we are." We weren't preaching. We weren't proselytizing. We were just visible. So I think that was one of the major things. Then we moved into things like we would we created a softball team. We joined the community league, and we play in the league. And that was also another building. Strength building time because it helped to rally our men and women because we all played and people would come out and support. We would meet other, you know, teams and they would get to know who we were. So it was just a myriad of different things that we would do to invest in the community. I made it a decision to, you know, to make sure I knew city council people. I would be involved in that. I knew, got to meet, you know, got to know the mayor, and just to be a part, say, hey, we're here. This is what we do. And even today, I mean, I retired in 2020 as lead pastor. And, after that, I became a volunteer chaplain with the police department. I still have great relations with the mayor and police department, fire department. We would do sponsor events for the local fire department. One day we'd buy pizza and just have a group of people take pizzas over to the fire department. No strings attached. Just, hey, we just want you to know we're right down the street. We're here for you. If you ever need anything, this is what we do. And so I'm still, even though I'm not pastoring, I'm still involved in the community. That's who I am. That's my DNA. And I think that pastors, if you really call, beyond the four walls of the church, you recognize that you need to make those connections. And unapologetically, just go and say, hey, my church is down the street. I just want you to know that, we're praying for you as a city council person. I just want to have a cup of coffee with you and let you know we're here, you know, and that's what we do. Yeah.
Thanks for describing all of that. I mean, I think that's something too that pastors sometimes just, I don't know if they don't have the imagination or vision, or maybe it goes back to what Michael said in terms of like, oh man, should I actually go and introduce myself to the community members? And I do think if you're trying to figure out the context of your congregation and your community, those kinds of relationships are really, really important.
I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off, but the other part of that is to get your congregation involved in the community. Mm-hmm. Join the citizens outreach committee, or get involved with, we've got one of our members who's a city council person, one who's on the school board, police department, you know, get them involved to say, you know, do some things outside of the church. Mm-hmm. Then you take your light to the community, and it's not just like, come to my church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. No.
It's a mutual relationship. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. when they see you're involved and you want to be a part of it, it changes the dynamic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us and going through all of those points. My last question for you is, do you have this like written down, or I do think you should consider doing one of the AMBS modules for leadership, just talking about these points, because I think they do kind of transcend various contexts and people could learn some things from this. You've been doing this for a while, and I really like how you encase that with Nehemiah and what you learned from him.
Hey, thank you all for allowing me the opportunity to share. I appreciate mm-hmm. it. And it's been good spending this time with you. So